94 by Senator Josephson. Is there someone, it is a straightforward bill. It simply takes out loperamide, which is an antidiarrheal prescription drug used by the elderly, from our criminal drug schedule. The federal government and all other states have done the same thing. Schedule this drug. Is there someone to testify on this legislation? Please come forward. Just give a quick brief.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Ayers, here today representing Johnson & Johnson, who has a product called Imodium. Imodium contains the antidiarrheal prescription drug loperamide. Without getting into a long discussion, Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me, do we have the bills, Beth, physically?
Yeah, we will have the originals.
Thank you. Excuse me. Bookkeeping this late hour.
In 1982, Mr. Chairman, members, in 1171-180, subsection C, a statement was added to the state statutes regarding controlled substances that reads that Schedule 5A includes loperamide. At the time, Mr. Chairman, that was taken directly from federal Schedule 5. In November of that same year, the federal government removed loperamide, but the construct of our controlled substances statute are not such that it allows for any kind of concurrent or automatic subsequent action to remove those kind of drugs from their descheduled by the federal government. For several years, Mr. Chairman, there have been amendments to other controlled substance bills that would have taken this drug off the controlled substance list, and in fact, those bills have not gotten through the legislature, and this simply removes that drug from the schedule. It's been off the federal schedule for over 5 years, and it is now off of all other state-scheduled controlled drug substances. This will not change the fact that this is a prescription drug, Mr. Chairman, nor will it alter the fact that pharmacists will continue to deal with this drug in a very controlled and proper manner.
Are there any questions? I've been approached about this, and I think the testimony is absolutely correct in the information I've got.
Mr. Chairman, are
you
ready for a motion?
Yes, I entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the Senate Bill 294 and individual recommendations, ask unanimous consent.
Out of objection, Senate Bill 294 has been moved to individual recommendation. The next bill The next bill is the Guardian Ad Litem, the Office of Public Advocacy. Legislation we've had previously in, I think we introduced it. Do you wish to testify, Beth, or somebody here to testify?
It's House Bill 7.
House Bill 7, with apologies, Senator.
Last year, for the record, my name is Beth Curtula, and I'm co-counsel for the committee, but last year you introduced this bill, and the bill basically helps fund the Office of Public Advocacy's Volunteer Guardian Ad Litem program. Right now, the Office of Public Advocacy has 20 volunteer guardian ad litems working with them. Guardian ad litem's job is to go into court in children's cases and tell a court what action it should take that's in the best interest of the child. They're very important, and we don't have any in the state, so volunteerism is extremely important to help out the office. The Office of Public Advocacy is afraid that without any state funding in January next year, they'll have to phase out the program. So the enthusiasm is there. In fact, they're going to have a class this weekend that has 20 people signed up to volunteer for it. So it's the kind of program the state should be promoting, volunteerism at little cost to the state. There's a fiscal note with it, and it has to go to finance after us. But I think it's a very straightforward, good bill, and will aid the Office of Public Advocacy in getting more volunteer guardian ad litems. The Office of Public Advocacy, of course, supports it, as does the administration, as Representative Sun's bill. Representative Sun would have been here today. His father is gravely ill, and he had to phone him to catch a plane last night.
If there's no questions, I do see the court chief administrator here who worked with me on the Office of Public Advocacy and actually lobbied it through, although we introduced the legislation. If there's no questions, is there a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I would move to pass House Bill 7 from the individual recommendations.
Not a, objection, House Bill 7 has been passed. The next bill before us is sexual abuse of the minor, 231, Senate Bill 231 by Senator Halford.
Senator Halford wanted to be here for that bill.
We'll put it off until he comes. He was here for a moment. That's all right. But the next bill before us is Senate Bill 59. Representative Davis here.
Representative Davis also wanted to testify on it, and he's in Representative Adams' office, but I think I can tell you about this bill in about 2 minutes.
All right, please, then, because we'll keep putting them off. This may be the next last meeting.
The only thing the bill does is it keeps our litter law penalty sections from sunsetting. Now, we've got a committee substitute that would lower the fine imposed from $50 to $25, and this was at the proposal of the sponsor. And it has various other groups, Alaskans Against the Litter's support. So I would encourage you to adopt the committee substitute. And the bill does just keep our litter laws from sunsetting.
Thank you. Through the chair of committee council, why would we wish to lower the fine?
Through the chair, the justification given by the sponsor is that it would reduce the amount of court challenges to the enforcement of the act so that people wouldn't be going to court so much. And groups felt that that was the right amount rather than $50.
I have some reservations, but I have to yield to the expertise of those people that work in the area, and if I can understand the rationale behind it.
Is there a motion on adoption of the committee substitute?
Mr. Chairman, I would so move for adoption of the committee substitute.
Objection. So ordered. Is there a motion to adopt the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we pass committee substitute for House Bill 59 from the individual recommendations.
So ordered. It is passed. The next bill before us, Senate Joint Resolution 15, the right to bear arms.
Mr. Chairman, there is a committee substitute proposed. If I might just briefly, Mr. Chairman, the committee substitute that you have in front of you is taken from the original bill and from the committee substitute proposed by Senator Rohde's office. As you'll recall, there's been a lot of debate about the bill. The committee substitute that's in front of you seems to hit the purpose of the author, whereas keeping in place some assurance for municipalities and for the state in regulating lawful use of firearms. I've got extra copies of the committee substitute for those who testify. This really is the Department of Laws and the Municipality of Anchorage is sort of bottom line, and it does incorporate the original bill and the proposed committee substitute from Senator Rohde's office.
Senator Rohde?
Mr. Chairman, there are several people here to testify.
We have a list here. If you wish them to testify, take them in order.
And I'm not sure if committee councilman has provided a copy yet.
I have not. The committee substitute was just delivered, so I apologize.
If you could give a copy. We'll ask Ms. Horetsky to come first, since she's the first to sign and currently wish to testify on SJR 15. And if there can be, you can take my substitute if you need it, Beth,
no,
to give to... Mr. Somerville and Mr. Andrews are both here wishing to testify. You have the floor if you identify yourself, please, and thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Gail Goreski. I'm with the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. As you may recall, Mr. Chairman, there have been previous hearings on this bill, and I was privileged to meet with Senator Rohde and with some other people from the Municipality of Anchorage, a gentleman from the NRA in Senator Rohde's office, and we did discuss a lot of the different issues involved here. Our concern, Mr. Chairman, to reiterate, is we have no problem at all with the concept of making it clear that the right to bear arms is an individual right, and I understand that's the main goal of the sponsor. And our only concern, Mr. Chairman, is to ensure that reasonable regulation by the state and by municipalities not be precluded. We did make some suggestions regarding the legislative intent language, and I think that by and large they have been incorporated here. So we have no problems with that legislative intent language. We still do continue to have some concern about the fact that the court will go first and foremost on the language of the amendment itself and not look to the legislative intent language if they contradict each other. I understand that there was, at some point, a different suggestion that the amendment read only, the right of each person to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, period. And I would urge the committee to consider this CS rather than that other language, the concern being that is an absolute statement and is not qualified in any manner, and that may be interpreted to preclude regulation, whereas the language of the existing CS recognizes that it has to be lawful defense of family property, recreation, et cetera, thereby making it clear that unlawful uses would be prohibited. I would be glad to answer questions, Mr. Chairman, if the committee has any.
Mr. Chairman, one of my proposals was that we, after considerable discussion with the Municipality of Anchorage and the Attorney General's office, that we merely strike the words of a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, which is the language of the federal courts, which have caused us to wonder whether this is a personal right. The Supreme, the language now says in the that you know, the right of the people to keep and bear arms should not be infringed, period, with the militia language in there now, and they've upheld all the laws. So the question is really whether we want a short version of the amendment or a longer version of the amendment. The Department is of Law, Ms. Reske has been very cooperative in terms of meeting, discussing this. We do however come from somewhat different points of view. My point of view is that the Supreme Court is able, with the existing language, to support all the municipal and state ordinances, and the language just says that well regulated militia is necessary to the security of free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, period. And within that, they found more than ample authority to support all the laws, and we don't, of course, seek to change those. And the argument is that if we change it, they wouldn't be able to do that. I don't know that logically follows, and certainly it's a judgment call, and I think my judgment is perhaps slightly different than that of the Attorney General's office. And of course, I'd be interested in hearing the comment from the National Rifle Association and the Outdoor Council on the question.
You have the floor,
Mr. Chairman. If I could just, I understand Senator's position, and we have discussed this at some length. The reason that the courts, when construing the existing language, have upheld reasonable regulation of the firearms under the Constitution is because they have pointed to the militia language and said it's a collective right, therefore reasonable regulation of individual use and possession is allowed. If you take away the language about the militia, you are taking away the peg on which the court hangs the hat of reasonable regulation being allowed. And I would refer the committee's attention, Mr. Chairman, to a memorandum issued by Legislative Counsel Mr. Bradley to this committee April 30th, 1986, regarding the predecessor to this bill. On the final page of that memo, Mr. Chairman, he talks about the identical proposal that Senator Rohde is suggesting now. And I'm quoting Mr. Bradley, with no context for the regulation, the statement becomes absolute and no regulation would be possible. Accordingly, I believe that some threshold basis for the regulation must be offered by the Constitution, such as the language about lawful hunting, lawful self-defense, etc. So it's not only the Attorney General's office, Mr. Chairman, that has some concern about that language. Legislative Council themselves have expressed that to me in a memo.
To the Attorney General, can you cite me one case in which the Supreme Court has used the term a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state as the hook to hang and said that it is a collective right rather than a personal right?
Are you talking about Alaska cases?
Yes. Is there any Alaska case?
Not that I'm aware, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. There are many other
state courts that have held that.
In other states, also there are other states that have language that says the right to bear arms should not be infringed. Period. Also, so in all deference to the comments by the Attorney General, there there never has been a interpretation of this constitutional amendment by the Supreme Court on that, quote, hook, that intellectual hook necessary to regulate Clevens in Alaska. They have found other means for upholding those regulations, and I would submit that they would do so under even my abbreviated proposal. The rest of my case.
Ms. Ratzke, if you will remain here, maybe you can sit next to Mr. Halford. You may wish to seek your counsel, at least your position. I would ask the next witness, Mr. Upa Andrews, to come forward. I apologize, however, today has been one of those days that we didn't have a committee substitute earlier. It was just impossible.
I apologize for being late. Sure. My bill was moved, so I'll leave before my next bill comes out.
One bill was moved.
Right? Yes, hope that it will work. Well,
that's how we're keeping Senator Halford.
Could I ask through the chair, to Ms. Horesky, do I understand that the draft CS, in your opinion, would meet Mr. Bradley's concern? That the judicial, this version would meet Mr. Bradley's concern in his memo? Sure.
Mr. Chairman, in my opinion, this version is better than the version that I understand Senator Rota to be proposing,
yeah.
And that is the language quoted by Mr. Bradley on the final page of his memo, page 6, which says only, which takes out the reference to militia and says only the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Because in this proposed CS, at least it's clear that there's a requirement that there be for lawful purposes. As I've stated in earlier hearings, Mr. Chairman, Senator Josephson, we would ultimately be more comfortable with specific language in the amendment saying, but the state or its political subdivisions may regulate the exercise of this right by law. As I understand it, that is not acceptable to the sponsor, and that language is not in the CS. This CS, from our point of view, is better than the shorter version where the militia language is really deleted.
In that regard, when you say, and for other lawful purposes, is that a kind of circular thing? Are other lawful purposes those purposes which the state, cities, and boroughs say are agreeable, and to the extent that they don't declare a particular purpose to be lawful, it is unlawful.
Mr. Chairman, basically yes. If the state says you can't have a loaded firearm in a bar, as our state statutes do say, then it would be unlawful to do so.
Oh, Mr. Chairman?
Yep, go ahead.
Maybe I'm not making myself clear. I understand that at the present time, a municipal government, and this is the Senator's concern, can limit the individual right to bear arms, or they think they can. And the Senator's purpose is to change that and at least put some constraints on what can be done to quote, infringe, unquote, on the right of an individual to bear arms. And my question is, if the people adopt this amendment that says that the individual has the right to keep and bear arms for the limit for the stated purposes and other lawful purposes, are the people doing anything except saying that you can bear arms when the government says you can and you can't bear arms when the government says you can't?
Mr. Chairman, I think what the amendment would make clear is that it's a personal right rather than a collective right, which is, as I understand it, is the intent of the sponsor. I have asked the sponsor several times, do you intend to repeal or make null and void existing law? And he always says no. So if that's not going to happen, then I think this language here reflects that purpose.
Mr. Chairman, if I could respond.
Yeah,
sorry, Mr. Andrews, to important discussion. I think the Honorable Caucus Chairman's position on this is correct, that it would essentially destroy the purpose of the amendment. For example, the borough of Western Alaska could decree that no game could be hunted with a rifle smaller than an elephant gun. And then it would therefore be unlawful to use anything else. The potential for mischief is significant, and Furthermore, it flies in the face, I think, of what most Alaskans view the right to bear arms to be. And it is, it is not my intent to upset the existing statutes. And the Supreme Court has upheld all of the statutes with the language that we have, which was drafted in 1776. So I think they would do an equally good job.
The floor, Senator.
I really, again, apologize for getting into the midst of something that I know so little about, but it seems to me that it would be better, if that's the Senator's intent, to say, and for lawful hunting, recreation, and other purposes lawful as of the date of this amendment, at least that does something. It says that the existing statutes and ordinances are grandfathered. It doesn't cover the problems of new governments that form and all of that. So there's a serious problem. But I just, again, Mr. Chairman, think that this language is completely circular. It doesn't solve anything.
Senator Alford?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe with the existing state statute that essentially says every able-bodied Alaskan that is not disqualified by reason of being a felon or something else, and whether they make the election overtly or not, is in fact a member of the militia. This language is worse than existing law.
Back to Senate Joint Resolution 15, Senator Rohde, did you have the original resolution, or have you prepared an amended resolution?
I have scratched out for committee council my version. My version would be very simple. It would just take the existing constitutional amendment and scratch out and delete the words, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. And in other words, the after it, and the amendment would then read, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, period.
I see. So then you, on page one of the original legislation, you're deleting a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of free state, comma, the?
Yes.
Now, are you also, again, deleting each citizen of the state, even though it doesn't show it here, because you're reinserting people?
The present language uses the term people, and there was a great deal of argument over whether you should use people, citizen, or each citizen. Quite frankly, I think we're better off to stick with the existing constitutional language. I trust in the reasonableness of the Supreme Court.
That is the only amendment proposed here.
I'm looking at a copy of the proposed committee substitute.
Could you look at your Senate Joint Resolution number 15 bill as introduced?
Yes.
Thank you. That may be the simplest. But you are doing a constitutional amendment. Does counsel have one? Senator, all right, if you identify exactly, Senator.
Okay, on
for the record.
For the record, starting title with the. The term a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of the free state would be deleted.
That's line 12 and 13, page 1.
Yes. And when it is deleted in that bill.
Yes.
And then the language would start out the, and then delete language, the right of each, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Would be my suggestion. The question of whether we should use the existing language of the people or each person is one that.
You propose that as a motion?
Yes.
Is there objection to that motion?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, you have.
It would then read Section 19, right to keep and bear arms, the right of the people of the state or not?
And the right of the people, you're using the existing, which is the existing constitutional language.
Just the people. The people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, and then everything else is cut out.
Well, how do you deal with the arguments of Ms. Oreski then that that puts into question the validity of existing laws and ordinances concerning misconduct involved in weapons?
The Supreme Court has made has upheld since 1959 all of the laws that we have to date, without invoking the limiting intellectual hook, if you will, that has been cited, and I think they will do that on the basis of reasonableness doctrine, because that is what they have used to date.
But they haven't had this amendment in the Constitution.
They've not been challenged on constitutional grounds, so far as I'm aware. Are you aware of it?
No, I'm not. Not to my knowledge. Mr. Chairman, through the Chair, I would, with the Chairman's permission, yield to Mr. Andrews.
But you have this proposition before us.
Yes.
I will take your testimony now, Mr. Andrews.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Ruth Andrews. I'm the field representative for the National Rifle Association in Alaska. I would like to make just a quick comment on the Assistant Attorney General's testimony. If what Ms. Oreski has proposed is adopted for language, what we're talking about here is creating a situation in Alaska that would lead to a Morton Grove, Illinois situation. That's exactly what we don't want to happen. All we're trying to do is to reaffirm the individual right to own and to lawfully and legally bear firearms, which I think she's agreed to, in the intent anyway. There's at least 38 or 39 states that already have a similar language in their state constitutions dealing with this issue to clarify the individual right. And if I'm not mistaken, there's at least one that reads almost identical to what you have before you in the substitute. I'm looking at a draft 5887. Our general counsel is aware, Mr. Chairman, of no misinterpretation by any state Supreme Court on the right of the state to persecute, prosecute people that negligently misuse firearms. I think that's your main objection or your main concern.
Do we have the copy 5887?
Mr. Chairman, I apologize. That's one that was proposed, and I thought that was in people's pack, but it's not. So I wish that I could go get it copied.
We'll copy it.
Okay.
Do you have any more testimonies?
I don't accept, Mr. Chairman, that 20 senators have sponsored this bill. It hasn't made it out of the first committee yet. I think we'd like to get an up or down vote on this.
Mr. Chairman, let me ask you a question.
Yeah,
what would be wrong? I have some concern about just doing the last proposal, because we could just be opening up, I hate to use the word Pandora's box, but that's been used a lot this week. What would be your feeling to the author and the witness about language that said for lawful hunting and recreation and didn't use the term other lawful purposes? I can't imagine what else there might be under
Mr. Chairman, defense of self and property. That's
well, it's in there that for lawful defense of self, family, property, and the state, and for lawful hunting and recreation, shall not be infringed by the state or by the borough.
This is basically the
bird
we're talking about, except it's changed.
This is set what?
The people to eat. That's the 5-8. That's what basically.
It seems to me that my point is, sir, that the phrase other lawful purposes has two problems with it. One is that to those who don't like the amendment, it suggests permission to do things with firearms that aren't in contemplation now. And for those who do like it, it suggests the possibility that government will come in and might carve out a lot of exceptions to the right, the rights of people with firearms.
Mr. Sperber, will you here testify on Senate Bill 7 or 15, House Bill 7 or 59?
Or House Bill 59, Senator.
We've already adopted it.
Thank you.
Safety then. Yes,
Chairman, a question to the Chair, to Mr. Andrews. In the short form that I proposed where we strike out the term a well-regulated militia, and just say that the right of the people to keep their arms shall not be infringed. Do you have any difficulties with that language?
Mr. Chairman, no, I don't. Mr.
Senator Rohde, make the motion. We'll see where it travels.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I would move without committee substitute that reads, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, period.
Senator Halper, would you like to look at it? Question is, shall this amendment be adopted? All those in favor signify by raising your right hand.
Opposed.
My left hand.
Are there other amendments proposed?
Mr. Chairman, I have a question.
You have the floor.
Have we now adopted Mr. Senator Brody's substitute of 5-8, or have we adopted the amendment to the original bill?
Amendment to the original bill, so far as I can understand. That's the one I would rule, unless I'm in there, we'll have to undo it.
Thank you.
We just have the original bill before us.
It's to be drafted as a CS.
It will be redrafted as a committee substitute. They can sign it out, but it will be redrafted. That motion's been adopted. Is there any testimony to that particular bill as now proposed to be worded by the amendment? You have the floor, Attorney General.
Mr. Chairman, in the CS dated 5-8, there has been some changes made in the legislative intent language. It differs slightly from the legislative intent language of the original bill, which has just been amended, proposed to be amended. I would urge the committee, if it believes appropriate, to adopt the legislative intent language as it appears in that Bradley 5-8 CS. Reason being, I think it explains a little bit more, as I understand the sponsor's intent for the language.
I would so move that the legislative intent.
What we have here then would be before us, sans the 5887 bill exactly. Is that the proposition, Senator Rohde? Here at the 5887.
Right.
Yes. And the changes were made with the kind assistance of Mr. Reski also.
I'll acknowledge that as an amendment to the amendment, which would make the other amendment or carry it, make it redundant. You have the floor.
Speaking to the amendment, it appears that the change is on line 23 in one version, but on line 19 in the other one. Changing or amending the Constitution, providing that the right to keep and bear arms is an individual right rather than a collective right, where the other one says is an individual right as well as a collective right. Is that the...
Mr. Chairman, that is one change. It also says, for example, the adoption of this amendment should not be interpreted as opposed to used to repeal or render unconstitutional statutes. Existing is taken out. Statutes or municipal ordinances. And then instead of specific citations, it says regarding assault, misconduct involving weapons, or similar offenses, other similar offenses. Instead of giving two specific statutory citations, it lists the kind of crimes which the sponsor does not wish to have affected by the adoption of the amendment.
What is the existing statute on misconduct involving weapons?
Mr. Chairman, there are several statutes regarding misconduct involving weapons, I don't know if I have that statute handy. It would prohibit such things as possession of a firearm while intoxicated, possession of a firearm in licensed premises, shooting over a roadway, CCW, felon in possession, giving it to a minor or to a firearm to a minor or to an intoxicated person, prohibited weapons, possession of prohibited weapons such as switchblades and things of that sort. There are several subsections of misconduct involving weapons in various degrees.
Assuming for argument that the legislative intent is followed by the court, and I think Mr. Bradley makes the point that because language like that, which was adopted just now by the committee, is arguably clear and plain, doesn't require legislative intent. Mm-hmm. Assuming that the court is willing to look to paragraph 2, would paragraph 2 deal with the situation, let's say, in the new borough at Kotzebue, if they want to adopt a criminal code after the adoption of the amendment, or does it refer only to statutes and ordinances that exist when the people vote?
Mr. Ritchie. Thank you, Madam Chair. That was one of my concerns, Senator, with the legislative intent language in the original SJS 15, because it says repeal or render unconstitutional existing statutes, where I think that a language as it appears in the Senator's proposed CS, dated 5-8, says repeal or render unconstitutional statutes or municipal ordinances regarding, and I think that in terms of allowing a political subdivision in the future to adopt statutes in the future, that the language in the 5-8 CS is better in terms of allowing that. I think it is going to be a question which ultimately will be litigated under the language that the committee is considering. For example, there's no state statute now that prohibits a loaded firearm on school grounds. I can certainly see where this body, 2 years down the line, may want to consider adopting a statute like that. Then the question becomes, can you regulate beyond existing boundaries? I don't know. That will be up to the court to decide.
Well, we could enact a conspiracy statute in the future related to certain kinds of weapons. We're doing that, starting down that road. Or we could increase the penalties for some of these offenses. And the question will come up whether we have the right to do that after the adoption of the amendment, correct?
See, Mr. Chairman, the concern I have, Senator, is that in other states, you've had a constitution that's been adopted, say, like in the 1800s, and then since then, the legislature has adopted numerous statutes. And the court construes the statutes in light of the constitution in that state and decides whether to give it effect or not. In this situation, we're reversing it. We have existing statutes, and then we're adopting a constitutional amendment. So then the question becomes, what does it do backwards in time?
You know, due to the exigencies of time, I think we should make a decision on this legislation.
I've moved the intent changes and would ask unanimous consent, Mr. Chairman.
As I understand it, that essentially is the 5887 legislation.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Is there objection? That will carry all previous action.
Do you wish a motion, Mr. Chairman?
I do.
Mr. Chairman, I would move we pass SJR 15 from committee with due pass recommendation.
Let's put it with the individual recommendation.
Individual recommendations, then.
Objection, so be it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Gail.
Next bill is Senate Bill 267.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. We're going to return to Senator Halford's bill.
If Senator Halford's here, yes. I didn't see him.
This guy didn't run.
We'll return now to Senate Bill 231 by Senator Halford, aggravating sexual abuse of a minor. We held it for his.
We haven't signed any bill.
I apologize. I talked to the chair about whether or not we should do that now or do it at the end. It's been just a little difficult for me to keep up with it, but I'm happy.
All right.
No, we'll do them all at the end because of the confusion. We'll take the last 5 minutes just to sign bills, as long as there's a majority left. Caden is ill. Thank you.
Have I got a deal for him?
Mm-hmm. Senate Bill 231 is before us. There is a proposed substitute by the Hess Committee, which is really before us at this stage. So it would be committee substitute for Senate Bill 231. Senator Helfer has the floor.
Mr. Chairman, the bill is pretty self-explanatory. It essentially equalizes the penalties for anyone who is exercising authority over a child, and provides that they are under the same penalties as whether they're married or not married, essentially.
Is there other testimony?
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I spoke with the public defender about this bill, and the Hess Committee incorporated her concerns, which was that to be eligible for this punishment, which is stiff, it's eight years mandatory term, that the person must be in authority over the child also. The reason for enacting that stiff penalty is that the person is violating sort of a sacred trust, sort of an incest sort of relationship. So the House Committee incorporated her concerns, and with that, she's neutral on the legislation.
Hess is pretty stiff in law and order. Is there a motion on the legislation?
Mr. Chairman, you have the floor.
I move CSSB 231 Hess from committee with individual recommendation.
Had considerable backing in the Hess committee and testimony. Objection so ordered. Individual recommendation. Is Senator Binkley or his staff here for Senate Bill 267?
Binkley's staff, I believe, was. However, if he's not, I can explain this legislation fairly quickly. I do not see he's in the next committee. If you'd like me to get him, or if you'd like me to explain.
I'll wait, Beth, until he shows up again. Senate Bill 247 by the Judiciary Committee. Are you ready to testify on that one? You have the floor, Mr. Snowden.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Art Snowden, Administrative Director of the Alaska Court System. We enthusiastically support this legislation. It basically provides that the municipalities will process their uncontested traffic citations that are issued under municipal ordinance. Basically, right now, Juneau does this, by the way, and it's done in part in other communities. At this point in time, for example, we are collecting in the court system approximately $533,000 for the municipality of Anchorage. 90% of that approximately is just an accounting function. These do not become contested whatsoever, so we're doing the accounting and passing the money over. We would ask the committee to entertain a CS, which both the judicial branch of government and the city of Anchorage support in both, because we consider it very good policy, which is basically the original bill introduced by Judiciary plus some sections that are technical in nature. But what they really say is that municipalities will set the fines under their municipal ordinances rather than the Supreme Court. The reason we think this is a very good idea, and Mayor Knowles supports this, is because things happen in the communities that are the subject of community morals, the community codes. For example, a couple of children may be hurt at a school crossing because people are acting improperly in their vehicles, and they want to. Someone thinks it's good policy. With the change, we would support it and urge the committee to support the bill. I would be glad to answer any questions that any member of the committee might have.
Mr. Chairman, would you like a motion to bring before us?
I'd have a motion to adopt the committee substitute.
Yes, I would move the adoption of the committee substitute to ask unanimous consent.
Objection. Is there a motion on the bill? It's pretty simple.
I'd move we pass Senate Bill 24.
You have the floor, Senator.
Let me ask you a couple of questions here. As a municipal ordinance, the peace officer deposits the citation with the clerk. Does the cited person send the money to the clerk of the municipality or to the Supreme Court, or either one?
If we have a change, Mr. Chairman, we would process state citations because that's our job. With the change, instead of the mail-in bail coming to the courts, it would go to the municipal clerk.
Okay. Now, suppose the offender is in court and pleads, or there's a disposition of the case. At present time, the judge gives a slip, or the clerk does, and the offender goes to another office and makes the payment, correct? Under this, would the offender then be expected to go across town to the municipal office and make the payment?
or how is it going to be done?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, this would only come when a ticket was uncontested. Somebody gets a ticket, it doesn't involve a valuable license or a jail term. It's just for infractions. The bail would be mailed into the municipality. Should the person not wish to contest that bail, they would send in their fine. If they do not, after 10 days, the municipality will switch the tickets over that the bail was not forfeited. Now they become cases, they should be in the court bailiwick. From then on, it's up to the court to process them and return any money to the cities.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Motion of adoption?
So moved. The CS Judiciary 51287.
Thank you very much for your time.
Would you do me the favor and tell Max Gruenberg that his bill will be read up? Thanks. Is there a representative of Senator Bankman here this time?
Beth? Mr. Chairman, he is tied up in Senate Transportation.
You understand the bill?
Yes, I can explain it if you'd like.
We have a substitute?
Yes, there is a committee substitute for it. Senate Bill 267, and I believe the committee substitutes are in the packets. However, if they aren't. What the bill does, currently in law, there's no requirement that someone have to sign their designation of where their limited entry permits to go upon their death in front of a notary or someone authorized by law to do so. And evidently there have been some challenges as to the person actually wanting and having their will say, this is where I want my limited entry permit to go to, so that Senator Binkley has introduced a bill that would require anytime someone wants to transfer a limited entry permit that they have to sign it before under oath or affirmation before another person authorized to administer an oath, and it has to be witnessed by two people. That's the only thing that this bill is going to do.
So motion to adopt the committee substitute.
I move to adopt the committee substitute.
No objection.
Mr. Chairman?
You have the floor.
Just a question. Does a limited entry permit normally an asset of an estate? And does this take it out of the estate?
Through the chair, I believe that it would be an asset of the estate. I think that this would allow someone to designate another person to be able to get the permit, someone in that way. But I think the law already allows that. It's just that there wasn't a provision that the person had to sign that transfer document in front of someone under oath.
Mr. Chairman,
you have the floor, sir.
I think from your explanation that would be right, that if you make a valid assignment or testamentary disposition under existing law, well, it wouldn't have to be in a will, actually, it would be by an instrument. It would be out of the estate. This actually probably will create more estate cases involving that as an asset, wouldn't it? Because the requirements to do this are going to be tightened up a little bit. You see what I'm saying? If anything, at the margins of it, there should be more permits in estates than out.
Mr. Through the chair, a policy observation. I'd like to, in cases where the permit holder dies and there is no family for it to go to, rather than have that permit then go to the estate, the attorney for the estate sells it on the market and the permit goes out, I'd rather have the permit extinguished as a matter of policy.
Let us sit on the bill until Senator Binkley can come to defend it.
Sir, could you disagree?
A question.
What are they doing now?
I'm not really sure. Mm-hmm.
This time we'll have Senate Bill 6. We will hold Senate Bill 267 until some member can come.
Mr. Gruenberg is here.
Yes, House Bill 6 by Representative Gruenberg. Please come forward and identify yourself, Mr. Majority Leader, just for the record. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Max Gruenberg. I'm a representative from Spinard. Appreciate very much your schedule for House Bill 6. I know that some of you have already seen this. And this bill passed the House as House Bill 688 last year and made it over to the Senate, wound up in Senate Finance when the session adjourned. And we passed it with about a total of 25 co-sponsors this year. It went to the Senate HES Committee first, and you have a Senate Committee substitute. The bill basically provides for a series of income tax credits for contributions to private and now, I mean, sorry, to public and now private universities, 2 and 4 year accredited nonprofit Alaskan colleges or universities. The bill always had both private and public universities and colleges, and then on the House floor, I took out private because I was concerned about ensuring its passage through the House this year. I have no problem either way personally, and the Senate House Committee put back private universities in. Originally, the bill had, at least when it passed the House, a $10,000 limitation per year for most of the taxes, and they increased it to $100,000 per year. And I'm looking at page 1, line 23, for example. What this is, Mr. Chairman, is essentially the same language for various types of taxes. It's for the business tax, the oil and gas production tax, the oil and gas property tax, the mining tax, and the raw fish processing tax. And the way it works, Mr. Chairman, is as follows. If, let's say, they give a $10,000, a taxpayer gives a $10,000 contribution in a year. Now, it's not an endowment, but a contribution. They would get a 50% actual credit against their state tax. The state, therefore, would wind up, in most cases, assuming a donation to APU or something like that, with 150%. In other words, 100% to the university and another 50% on their taxes. So it's an additional 50% to the state. The taxpayer would then turn around and write off the remaining 50% on their federal tax. So the federal government becomes an involuntary donor, depending upon the tax bracket, of maybe up to 40% or 50%, 30%, whatever their tax bracket is. And so the federal government becomes a partial contributor, and the actual total cost to the donor winds up somewhere in the neighborhood of 30%. It's a good deal for them, a good deal for the university, a good deal for the state, because the state can take this into consideration in appropriating to the university the next year, and the federal government becomes an involuntary donor. Anyway, that's what it is, and we think that it can raise some money for the university. Revenue is going to testify here in a minute. Mr. Kettle is here. And one of the concerns they have is that they don't want this to be precedent for opening the barn door for anything else. And what we've prepared, Mr. Chairman, is an amendment that... I understand you've looked and you don't have any problem with that.
No.
Okay. The amendment here, Mr. Chairman, at the request of revenue, simply indicates in the purposes section that this is really a unique kind of a policy because education has a unique place and we're not intending really to open the door. I do support that amendment. With respect to the other question that revenue will
raise... The amendment is to the House Committee substitute, right?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. And that was at revenue's request. We drafted it. I don't have any problem with it at all. Revenue will say that... they would like to keep this as small as possible, going back to the $10,000 figure. Remember, I mentioned that the Senate Test Committee raised it to $100,000. That is the committee's choice, what the total amount you want to have is. If you look, you'll see in a couple places, instead of $100,000, it says $10,000. I'm looking at page 2, line 19, page 3, line 9. And the reason it has those figures there is because those two taxes, the oil and gas production tax, the oil and gas property taxes, are monthly taxes rather than yearly taxes. So if you go back to the $10,000, those would be at $1,000. If you choose something in between, whatever you choose is fine with me. And I'm delighted to answer any questions. Thank you.
Mr. Kettle, would you come forward and testify? Max, would you sit at the table? We're going to try to move right along. We ask you to be very clipped, if you will, Mr.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Steve Kettle. I'm with the Department of Revenue. Generally, we have no problems with this tax credit for contributions to higher learning. We are, as the majority leader says, fearful of opening Pandora's box one more time, fearing that many other very worthwhile public and nonprofit organizations will be coming back next year. Secondly, we're concerned with the tax credit limit being raised from $10,000 to $100,000. I'll leave my remarks at that.
Other question, Mr. Kelly, Mr. Gruenberg. Is there a motion to adopt the Gruenberg Amendment?
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Without objection, Gruenberg Amendment, Amendment 1 to CES for House Bill 6 has been adopted.
Mr. Chairman.
You have the floor.
In view of the testimony from the author and the witness, I would move to revert back to the lower figures.
That's a maximum of 10,000 in each
yes,
of those
sir.
Other areas,
Jack? 10,000, 1,000, 1,000, 10,000, and 10,000. May I speak to that?
You may speak to it. There's another witness that wishes to speak to
I have the need language we prepared so you know where it goes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well,
you have the
Mr.
floor.
Chairman,
you've made the motion. You'll okay. pass out the materials.
I think that the.
We can just pass them, Beth. Senator Halford, here you've got too much.
I think the House Majority Leader has come up with an interesting idea, which is designed to stimulate donations and give the donor some federal tax benefits. On the other hand, the Department of Revenue has some concerns. It does, to a degree, involve itself in what has been the legislature setting up priorities through the usual general fund process, collecting revenues and then allocating them. And I think maybe we should put our toe in the water first before we put our whole body into the water.
You move these to be adopted. We'll probably come up with many subsequent with these two major amendments. Ms. Redmond, do you wish to testify on this amendment?
Yes, sir. For the record, my name is Wendy Redmond with the university. I guess, Mr. Chairman, Senator Josephson, I consider $100,000 to be a toe since we wanted $1 million. So, from our perspective, the $100,000 is actually more reasonable. And in talking with the members of the foundation in terms of the kind of fundraising they do, $10,000 is not a large contribution. What we're looking for here are large corporate contributions. There is a section in the bill on page 4, line 3. You'll see on September 30th of each year a detailed listing of what contributions under this act would be given to the university. I assume that the legislature, if for some reason all of a sudden we were beginning to pull in millions of dollars each year under this act, that our general fund would be adjusted to reflect that kind of activity. I don't expect that that will happen. We certainly believe that this bill will give us a tool to do the kind of fundraising that the university should be involved in. I would urge that if $100,000 seems too high to you, that perhaps $50,000 would be more appropriate, but I do feel that $10,000 is too low.
I'm persuaded. I withdraw my
Senator Halford?
This is one of the
Pardon?
How much does the order?
Tim's withdrawn. He's withdrawn the amendment. Mr. Chairman, the
yes.
amendment has been withdrawn due to the.
Gruenberg 2 has been withdrawn. Would you like a motion on the bill, Mr. Chairman?
I would.
Mr. Chairman, I would move we pass House Bill 6 from the committee with individual recommendations.
Without objection. It will come out, yes, with this amendment, I think.
Yeah. Amendment number 1.
Yeah, House Bill 6 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. Next item on the calendar, then, is Community Regional Affairs, Municipal Sales and Use Taxes. And it's got the banking.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that Mr. Campbell had a committee substitute that he was preparing for
yeah,
this.
Where is
we
Mr. Campbell?
Beth, we'll just go to the next one. You have a very important meeting in 10
okay.
moments.
As soon as you're at the ready to speak.
Mr. Joseph, yeah. you have the psychologist bill. We're going to go to 252. Hold the other one.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The existing law, Senate Bill 252.
We're going to Senate Bill 252.
Existing law 886-200 prohibits a psychologist or psychological associate from reviewing any communications made by a client during the course of therapy. However, there are situations where some disclosure is required by other considerations.
One is, for example, in incidents of child abuse or elder abuse, where we pass laws and direct that the therapist report those cases. Another is where a disclosure is required by the rules of evidence promulgated by the court. There are also cases where the psychologist is the defendant in a malpractice claim or other proceedings, and where some disclosure may be necessary to give the psychologist an opportunity to defend. And finally, there's the situation where the client is making threats of serious harm to a third person, whom the psychologist could save by disclosing the communication. This bill is requested by the Psychological Association, and it avoids or overcomes those discrepancies, Mr. Chairman, and overcomes the existing problem where the psychologist had told him one law not to do something, and then required by another law to do that very thing.
Is there a motion on the bill?
I would move SB 252 with individual recommendation.
Stand through, yes. Objection, SB 252 has to move out of committee with individual recommendation. Is Mr. Campbell here at this time?
Mr. Chairman, I apologize, he is not, but I think you need to wait a minute to find out what...
Well, the next item is Mr. Binkley's representative here, and then we'll go to...
Here's Mr. Binkley.
Yes, please come forward. There was a question.
Here, Mr. Chairman.
Good. We will try and see if we can answer the question. We can return to Senate Bill 267, which was a limited entry permit transfer upon the death of the permit holder. And at that time, after the testimony given by Beth, there was a question about whether or not the transfer should occur, should remit to the state, et cetera. And I think maybe Senator Halford or Senator Joseph had that question.
What's the practice now with these permits?
Okay. For the record, my name is Mark Ernest, aide to Senator Binkley. Mr. Chair, maybe I could just give about a 2-minute synopsis on the problem.
Okay. That did that. So, okay, due to the time problem, 15
sure,
minutes, three bills.
Okay. this was patterned after the ANCSA stock certificates. There is a provision on those certificates which allowed for the person, the stock owner, to designate an individual on the stock certificate, which is then witnessed by two individuals and notarized. And in the case of the small villages in rural Alaska, in each case there is a person who can perform a notary service, and it's usually the postmaster in those communities. So this was an attempt to try to keep these cases from going into probate court through just because of a lack of a will, and it's patterned after, like I said, the ANCSA share. So I tried to answer any questions. I'm not an attorney, but I'll do the best I can.
Senator Joseph, I believe you did have a question. You are Senator Halford, it seems to me. So why it shouldn't be good?
Well, do these permits, if there's no heir or no designation of a recipient, do they go into an estate, or do they escheat back to the state, or what happens?
I'm going to get the technical terms wrong, but let me just explain in English that they would be as personal property. They would be passed on through a will, or in the case of the limited entry permits, through a lack of a will, they would be transferred to the spouse, surviving spouse.
Well, let's say there's no spouse.
That's what this bill addresses. In those cases, on the back of the certificate, that individual can designate a recipient.
Okay, and that takes it out of the estate. It's not part of the estate assets, but it goes, on the instant of death, it goes to the person designated.
That would be that's the intent of the bill.
So this really just tightened it up to make it a little more certain that was the intent of the owner of the permit.
Well, actually, it provides a little more flexibility in this process, in that it allows an individual, because most people out there just don't have wills, and it ends up in probate court. It just gives them one other option that they can say, okay, this is going to my eldest son, Jack, and that's then witnessed by two people, or Uncle Harry, or somebody.
Yep. I mean, they can do that now.
Only through a will.
Only through a will.
Yes.
I see. Okay. So this gives them with the same formalities of a will, but in terms of witnessing, but without going to a lawyer to get a will drafted, it allows them to do the same thing. Have I got it?
That, to the best of my ability, yes.
Senator Sturgis.
That's the intent.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's what I was trying to get. What happens now if X dies without a will, has no spouse, has to go into the court, but if they don't have anybody designated, that person may not get it. This way, they can die without a will, but if they have signed the certificate saying, I want Joe to have it, my friend, Joe can have it.
My senator. There is a committee substitute. That's not here.
Is that right?
Do you understand a committee substitute?
Yes, Senator.
You recommend that?
That's fine.
Is there a motion to adopt committee substitute?
I so move.
Objection. Is there a motion to adopt the bill? Send it out.
I move to adopt the bill and then the recommendation.
Without objection, it is adopted. 267 has been passed out of committee and the recommendation.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
We're back to Mr. Campbell is here on my staff. This very simple bill.
Yes.
That was introduced because of a problem that came about through the revision to Title 29, the only one I might add. And there is a committee substitute, and if we could possibly have just a brief explanation of what happened. Would that be appropriate?
Yes, we can have. I see other members who know that.
Yeah,
this is a
guest
of committee substitute. We have one other bill that I hope we can hold a hearing on yet today, and that's House Bill 196, if it is at all possible subsequent to this. We have 282 before us. There is a suggested committee substitute. However, I'll ask for testimony by Mr. Mackay Campbell first, if he'd identify himself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mackay Campbell, staff of the Senate Community and Regional Affairs Committee, Senator Strzelewski, Chairman. I'll try to be very brief. I would just say that up until 2 years ago, there was not a priority for sales tax liens, nor indeed a mechanism for boroughs to place sales tax liens on real property. With the adoption of Title 29, one of the inadvertent, I believe, results was that sales tax liens wound up with a priority over prior reported mortgages. This created a very substantial problem for the banking and lending community because though they could have a complete title search, a sales tax lien could pop up afterwards and then have priority over them. We have had a legal services did a search, and I believe your staff has provided you with a memo that no other of the rest of the 49 states has such a law. What the bill before you and what the proposed committee substitute would do is amend the existing law to state that the sales tax liens have a priority except for property taxes, special assessments, and adding in prior recorded mortgages, trust deeds, and land sales contracts. The additional language there makes certain that this section applies to both home rule and general law municipalities. And section 2, the addition of the subsection E in 29.10.242, also does the same thing. This section is simply a listing of statutes that apply to home rule and general law municipalities. We have worked on this with the banking and lending community, as well with the Municipal League, and I believe all parties are generally supportive of this legislation.
Do you wish to move the committee substitute be adopted?
So moved.
Objection.
Chairman, unless there's a desire to hear witnesses.
No, there is no desire to hear witnesses.
I would move the bill. It's very urgent, Bill.
That's what I understand. Are you here on this particular bill?
I'm on that particular bill.
Do you want to just formally make a statement of support?
Just the administration supports this bill, and I was here to just testify to the committee, and I testified before Senator Strzelewski's committee that for Ada and for us to have the finance and for Fannie Mae, this is an important bill.
This is testimony by the Commissioner of Commerce, Mr. Smith. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator.
Without objection, has there been a motion to move it out?
Yes.
Without objection. Sure. This time, there's House Bill 196. If there's witnesses for House Bill 196, we have a brief period of time to hear them. I would ask that you be brief because we have such a short period. If hopefully this bill will speak for itself. You may introduce yourself, Bob.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Engelbrecht. I am the president of the Alaska Air Carriers Association, here to testify in support of House Bill 196. Basically, this bill was introduced to enhance the ability of Department of Commerce
to enforce the state minimum liability insurance requirements that were passed after the ATC commission was sunset. So far, the state has not actively enforced these requirements because the Departments of Commerce and Law felt the penalty enforcement provisions were inadequate, and this bill simply tightens those up. It also simplifies administration by allowing fleet certificates for aircraft. And the fee for this will be set by regulation after 1989. Urge your support in the passage of this bill. Answer any questions.
Senator Halford has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I was confused by the delayed effective date and the tie-in of the fees, because Section 5 of the bill says the fees are going to be this, and Section 6 says they'll be set by regulation. Section 12 says that Section 6 takes effect a year and a half from now. Why don't we simply set the effective date on? I mean, why do we do Section 5 just for this interim period? Why don't we go ahead and say the fees will be set by regulation and go?
Well, the fees were $50 per aircraft, and this bill would change it to $50 for one aircraft or $100 for a fleet of two or more. This just reflects what generally is done in the industry, where you have one certificate of insurance for a fleet aircraft, no matter what size, and allows the fee to be set by regulation to reflect whatever the costs are of administering this. We're just trying to keep it simple.
Ms. Barrett seemed to want to testify to this specific position. Do you wish to testify at this time to just this specific question?
Yeah, I would.
Please identify yourself.
My name is Becky Bear. I'm legislative liaison to the Department of Commerce and Economic Development. There was concern in the House side that if it was left just open at this time, the department might take the fees sky high. On the other hand, there's also concern by the administration and the department that fees that get set in regulation have a tendency not to change and become obsolete down the line, and it's next to impossible to change them. So the compromise that was worked out was that the fee would be set in regulation for 2 years, and after 2 years, then we could adjust it if it was necessary. And I would add for the committee that the department does support the bill.
That's merely a clarification. It didn't specify rotor as a part of the definition of aircraft, and there was some question about that, so it was inserted to clarify that.
Well, what was the original intent? Do you know?
It was to cover rotor and fixed wing.
I think we'll hold this bill the next meeting. I'm going to ask Senator Halford to have a good look at it. Do you have no objections to it from your experiences?
Mr. Chairman, I would move the bill with individual recommendation that
not objection. I went through it, noting the rotor and other additions, and noting the trip that was taken. However, we did deregulate, essentially.
They'll get it all
done.
Deregulate.
We'll keep dinking with it. The bill has been moved out. No objection. Individual recommendation, House Bill 196. The balance of the bill is, because we have to sign these, will be taken up along with some others on Thursday's meeting. Those are the Kelly bills, which Senator Kelly understood there were supposed to be some serious amendments opposed to those bills. I don't know if they've been made or not. But in order to get these other bills to the calendar, and the other one being a constitutional amendment, we'll just take them up next time.
The chair,
we just have to sign these, if you will.
Have they done that?
I don't think so. Have you done some amendments, serious amendments to this bill that were proposed?
No, but we have a fast track way to address the issues in the bill and get it going.
Okay. It'll be top of the calendar Thursday then.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. We try to initiate contact for some period, as you know, and I don't have any. What's up?
They just want to.
No, we just move these.